Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Yes, sometimes I feel like you were so cruel, like you were so cruel, like Judas Iscariot and Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible and Henry the Eighth, and there's you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Y'all like Bonnie? Arkansas, born and bred, Bonnie Montgomery is a classically trained composer and opera singer by day and a honky-tonk queen by night. Bonnie has appeared in publications such as The New Yorker, The Huffington Post, and The London Daily Telegraph. More can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Oxford American South on Main in downtown Little Rock for our Season 9 Shakespeare in the South show. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Shakespeare Theater. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each show we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock illustrator Philip Rex Huddleston, and the featured piece is this piece right over here, which is entitled A Good Man is Hard to Find and is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Philip at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight is our third annual Shakespeare in the South show, where our stories and storytellers are all influenced in various ways by the Bard. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Greg Brounderville tries his hand at love on a midsummer night in Arkansas, and we'll end the night with Sarah Shoemaker, a book, and a secret. But let's start the night with Stacey Margaret Jones as she invokes the Bard in When One Needs a Poet.
I am a poet. I write poems about the frightening menace of trees plotting a land grab in the Delta, deer jumping over barbed wire fences in the Dakotas, and how my Arkansas friends say whenever instead of when, as in, whenever I was young. But even though love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind, as Shakespeare wrote in A Midsummer Night's Dream, I have not felt successful as a poet writing about my husband. This is a man who definitely looks with his mind, an academic, a writer, and a poem quoter extraordinaire. I have tried to write poems to him, but I am never satisfied enough to commit to them the way one must if one wants to end up with a worthy poem. Tinkering, reordering, playing with sounds and enjambment, that comes after I find enough of something worthwhile and original. And you know that if you just start pairing, whittling, shaping, substituting, shifting, thesaurusizing, you'll be able to craft that insight into a poem. Early in my career, my editor for my op-ed page column at a daily newspaper told me she couldn't write about things she cared too much about. In fact, when she wrote unsigned editorials, she preferred to write against her own positions. The topics about which she was passionate were too unwieldy to shape into pith and punditry because they were just too big to her. Because my husband and his support for me undergird nearly everything good in my life, I have trouble finding the hook to hang the poem on, the specific, imagistic thing by which I can make this wide love narrow enough to write about. And at the risk of tempting fate, I will quote another famous writer, Leo Tolstoy, for one more excuse. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. I guess I could blame Jay. If we were actually unhappy, I would have so much more creative material or drama to work with. Writers are guilty of using loss, pain, and suffering to some degree for inspiration, for an opportunity to exhume and examine hurt, and then, if not to heal it, to resolve it, or to resolve our thinking about it. One of my husband's favorite poems is Sharon Olds' I Go Back to May 1937, in which she imagines having the power to keep her parents from marrying and going on to live through all the pain they would cause each other and their children in the ensuing years. My favorite poet is Sylvia Plath, so enough said. The truth is, when one cannot write a poem, one must rely on a poet. And one can rely on Shakespeare, at least I've found. As the years in our marriage add up, we're about to celebrate our lucky 13th year together, I've come to rely particularly on Shakespeare's sonnet 116. I'd like to break that one down a little for you tonight and show you just how much the poet of the evening knew about our marriage here in Arkansas all these centuries after he lived so far away. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments, my husband says, when I thank him for his forbearance for one of my many faults, this particular writer's block included. And he doesn't admit impediments. He doesn't get upset about our differences, that he is the problem identifier and I am the problem solver, that he is neat to a fault and I am a slob, which actually is a fault. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds or bends with the remover to remove. This is really the test, isn't it? Because I've changed over the 20-plus years we've known each other. A great deal of that change has happened since we moved to Conway, Arkansas in 2003. Whatever new interest bender I'm on, yoga, running, veganism, meditation, presidential homes tours, none of which were in my repertoire when he married me, he loves me, whether he loves the new craze I'm indulging, which he often does not. He even joins me. 2 years ago, he ran 3 half marathons in 12 months because I was doing them. He biked the Big Dam Bridge bike, 30-mile ride on an old hand-me-down bike, so we could do that together too. In December, he went 7 days without meat, dairy, or eggs because I wanted to try being vegan for a week. He's been to yoga with me twice in the last month and sometimes joins me for sun salutations in the morning before he walks the dogs. Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. Can we say that my husband Jay is not shaken? I think we cannot. He is shaken by heights, by the mere thought of watching The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, and of the idea of eating shrimp. But, of course, Shakespeare is not writing of whether the person is rattled or wobbly at times, but rather of the commitment to the loving relationship that is steady and never shaken. So I will remind you of Vegan Week. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Although it may be difficult to calculate Jay's worth in dollars, I have a sense of what he's been worth to my sanity, to my psyche. Here's just one example of what a daily dose of him can do. In the mid-1990s, while I was living in the Czech Republic teaching English, I had an opportunity to take a trip to Greece, and all I had to pay for was my plane ticket. I found myself staying in a beach hotel about 40 minutes outside of Thessaloniki, alone. The season hadn't begun yet for the Russian tourists who filled the resort town all summer where no one spoke anything but Greek or Russian. For 8 days, I lay on the beach, read books, or took myself on excursions in the region. On day 5, I found a payphone and called Jay in order to have a conversation with someone else. Thank God I reached you, I gushed. I'm getting so sick and tired of me. From thousands of miles away, I felt seen, heard, and loved. And you know the sonnet, and don't need more examples from me for these lines. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. But I'd like to spend a moment on the final couplet before I leave you this evening. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. The speaker here is vociferous. If this isn't true, I take it all back, and no one has ever loved in the history of time either. This is the kind of thing Jay would say when he is sure of something. In fact, throughout the history of our relationship, I've described him as intractable in the best possible way. This does seem to belie the assertions I've made about his willingness to try new things with me. This isn't a contradiction of his character, but rather another facet of it. Because that dude has things he will not do. He will not watch Real Housewives, for example. He refuses to take a trip to Vietnam, and he will not drink a martini. I've always described his flexible inflexibility like this. If it's at all possible for him to do something I want him to, he will, even if he doesn't want to, like getting a third dog. But if for any reason he is really against it, he cannot be talked into it, no matter what, like getting a fourth dog. But isn't this intractability what Shakespeare is describing to us throughout the sonnet? This keen fixation on what is lovable within the beloved is the subject of all 14 lines of the poem. It is too bad I cannot yet make a poem out of my husband. But if I could make a person out of Sonnet 116, it would be my husband. If only there were some way I could let him know. Thank you.
Stacey Margaret Jones is a writer and market researcher. She's a regular contributor to Sporting Life Arkansas. Her essays have appeared in Elephant Journal, and her poems have been published in Agave, Slant, and Ariel. Next, it's Greg Brounderville, his crush, and some magical juice in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Arkansas style.
One night, I was out at a place called Six Trees near Pumpkin Bend, Arkansas, and the girl I was crushing on showed up. I was 17 and had been dreaming and dreaming about her for 3 years, obsessing over her. Some days, I was unable to think of anything else. She was so pretty, so smart. In math class, she got all the problems right without seeming to try or care. Like all great beauty, she never showed her work. Every item of her clothing, every curl in her hair seemed to be choreographed by the gods of beauty. But this night, I noticed her eyes were a little rolly, her lips a little floppy. It was like her face muscles weren't holding her face together like they should. Clearly, she was drunk. And amazingly, she walked straight over to me, walked straight over and said, "Hey there, sex pot." I was somehow vaguely aware of this term, but I had never heard anyone say it in real life. Sex pot? Now, my family and I attended a small Pentecostal church in our small town, and we were teetotalers from the word go. No alcohol at home, and none at church functions, certainly none during the Lord's Supper. My Sunday school teacher did allow that Jesus had once turned water into wine at a wedding feast, and by wine, she clarified, we mean grape juice. Which was helpful, because until I heard this brilliant elucidation of the matter, I was all tangled up trying to make sense of that verse, you know, where the governor of the feast says to the bridegroom, says, "You know, you're not like most folks. Most folks bring out the good wine first and wait till everybody's good and drunk to pour the cheap stuff. But if it was just grape juice, see, well, then it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever." But anyhow, evidently it was grape juice. I should make it plain that the teetotalism of Pentecostals is of a notably different character from that of certain other denominations, whose abstinence from alcohol is rooted in a dour commitment to temperance. If a Pentecostal leaves alcohol alone, he does so mainly because he doesn't need it. He gets a buzz off God. As holy roller preachers often say, why get drunk on spirits when you can get drunk on the Spirit? They might just have a point. If you take a moment to compare these two methods of inducing tizzies of delight, you realize heavy drinking has downsides that ecstatic worship lacks. For example, when you go out on Saturday night and get destroyed on whiskey, instead of spontaneously being able to speak in other tongues, you lose the ability to speak intelligibly in English. And that's not all. After a party night, you might wake up the next morning with one of those busting open headaches, whereas after getting drunk on the Holy Ghost, you wake up the next morning feeling like a champ. No headache at all. Unless, of course, you passed out in the spirit and hit your head on a pew on the way down. A not uncommon occurrence in my boyhood church, it turns out. When somebody passes out during Pentecostal worship, he or she is said to have been slain in the spirit. Another strange Pentecostal phenomenon is the so-called holy cackle, which is raucous, uncontrollable guffawing that doesn't have any outward trigger. This is one area in which the effects of strong drink and those of the Holy Ghost are strikingly similar. One of the downsides of Pentecostalism, especially if you're a girl-crazy teenage boy, has to do with the, shall we say, unique customs of self-presentation among Pentecostal women. Essentially, there are two modes. On the one hand, there's a complete lack of glamorous adornment or embellishment of any kind, rendering that singular, washed-out, mega-holy look. And on the other, there's Tammy Faye Baker. Two extremes and no in-betweens. In our church, we had ample representation of both of these unfortunate aesthetics. The upshot of which was that I decided to go questing for love in places other than church. The most promising such place, at least in my adolescence, was a small patch of trees in the middle of a vast rice field where kids gathered on weekends. It felt a little hidden, a little wild. In a world of cleared woods and vast swaths of cropland, this area felt like a magical forest. And there was a secret behind its name. We called it Six Trees, on account of there being six trees. Six Trees bore some similarity to the woods in Shakespeare's play, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Our trickster figure, our Puck, was a 22-year-old man boy with a certain elfin mischief to his personality. He was the only one of us who could purchase alcohol, and purchase he did, beer, bukus of it. His beers of choice were Budweiser and Schlitz. Schlitz was onomatopoetic in that once my pals had downed a little, one of their favorite cuss words came out sounding kind of like Schlitz. In Shakespeare's version, Puck's magical juice comes from a plant, and if spread over any sleeping person's eyelids, causes that person to fall in love with the first thing he or she sees upon waking. Similarly, the magical juice given by our Puck had its origins in the plant kingdom. For example, in rice fields, like the one where Six Trees was located. And though beer wasn't applied directly to the eyes, it certainly affected them. And once it had cast its spell, you pretty much would fall right in lust, if not in love, with the first thing you saw. This is a common and widely documented phenomenon known as beer goggles. Being a good Pentecostal, I refrained from drinking even when I went to Six Trees. I was typically the only person there who was refraining, which put me at a very real advantage and a very real disadvantage. On the one hand, a sober person among a bunch of drunks is able to control himself, mostly avoiding fistfights and generally winning any he does get in, since the other guy's swings are like the flailing strokes of an uncoordinated swimmer. On the other hand, when you're sober and everybody else is drunk, you feel like a ghost, there but not there, not fully a part of the fun. The inner dialogue goes something like this: I'm so poised and dignified. Even elegant, you might say. Look at these other guys, making total idiots of themselves, dancing, stumbling, mumbling, making out with all the girls I wish I were making out with. But then came that night. That girl, that word, sex pot. I wasn't even sure I liked her anymore. The problem wasn't that I felt objectified. I had no objections to being objectified. Let's be honest, it was pretty much my dream to be objectified by a beautiful woman. But with those floppy red lips, rolly eyes, and this new unsavory vocabulary, she wasn't the girl I'd fallen for. But then she kissed me. I got my first taste of Puck's intoxicating beverage from her lips. Suddenly, my reservations about the indignity of her drunkenness fell away. I had trouble imagining that I ever could have harbored such reservations. They were just the naive hang-ups of the impossibly inexperienced little boy I had once been, circa 5 seconds ago. This Saturday night version of my dream girl was even more beautiful and interesting than her too perfect daytime self. There with me at Six Trees, she was human. She was real. Or was she? It was that too perfect daytime version of her that as of Monday morning went back to neither knowing my name nor deigning to talk to me in the hall. And then I was left with a question that I'm left with at the end of Shakespeare's rendition of this story. Can we attribute the sudden dramatic changes in the hearts of boys and girls to beer or the juice of a magical flower with wondrous and reversible effects? Or is the intoxicant simply an excuse for the inconstancy and mystery of young love or young lust? And when we mature into our adult selves and adult relationships, if they lack the unbearable intensity of those high school infatuations, have we gained more in stability than we have lost in excitement? And what about those dancing, shouting, moaning, singing Pentecostals I knew and loved? Were they trying to preserve in themselves the beautiful, childlike excitement that adulthood conspires to steal from us? Was Shakespeare, who toyed with words to orchestrate magical spectacles for himself and others, not doing the same thing? How about me in my unlikely avocation of poetry? And come to think of it, how about you here tonight to help give life to stories?
Greg Rounderville, a native of Pumpkin Bend, Arkansas, is the author of two books, Gust and Deep Down in the Delta. He is assistant professor of creative writing at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. In our final story of the night, Sarah Shoemaker is seduced by an older man in Taking Shakespeare to Bed.
I was 12 years old the first time I brought William to bed with me. I snuck him into the house and hid him in my room. That night I was nervous as I climbed into bed. Under my great-grandmother's woolen quilt, Shakespeare lay beside me. It was silent, the rest of the household sleeping, before I pulled the covers over my head, tentatively placed my hand on the dark blue denim of Shakespeare's Yale jacket, and drew him closer. At first, that was all. We lay there, not speaking, with the covers pulled over us, a tent of cotton and hot air. Inches apart, and I couldn't even look at his face. I wanted to, too much. It was hard to believe. William Shakespeare was there, in bed with me. I kept trying to seem natural, trying not to pant or stutter, but I knew his words would be better than mine. Far cleverer, and that he knew more than me. He'd be witty and worldly, fearless and funny, able to talk about anything, love, fighting, identity, even sex, especially sex. That's what I'd heard, that he could teach me if I wanted to learn, but I'd have to look in his direction first. I'd have to open my eyes, be brave and willing, and at least pretend that I knew what he was talking about. So I slid my hand across his back, traced his spine with my fingertips, and flipped his jacket open. Only weeks before, we'd met for the first time. I'd heard of him. I mean, people would talk about him. Some liked him. Some admitted they didn't know him, really. Others said his language was too poetic. They didn't get him, but everyone said he was great. Like, you could hate him, and he was still that guy you couldn't deny was just awesome, important, a somebody. I'm certain he had never heard of me. But one Saturday afternoon, just before dusk, I was outside doing chores, carrying firewood to fill the rack for the wood-burning stove, when I met Shakespeare. He was leaning against a stack of kindling, wearing a tight blue cotton Yale jacket, stained with watermarks and a bit disheveled. Already rough around the edges, but slim and beautiful. I knew how he must have gotten there. A lot of things turned up from the farm auctions my dad went to on the weekends. Dad liked to keep up appearances, from going to sales in the community to being well-groomed. And he expected it of others. You care for yourself. You care for your things. His hair never grayed, and he was perpetually tan. I thought he looked like Cary Grant. Next to him, Shakespeare looked ragged and disreputable, not fit to go inside the house. So there he was, sitting outside in the cold on the edge of the burn box, where my dad must have left him. That was how William Shakespeare and I met. He was leaning over a copy of L.M. Montgomery's Rainbow Valley, and that was how I rescued him. When my father noticed Shakespeare wasn't out with the kindling, he knew it was my doing. Jagged, filthy, torn and faded, probably has lice or something worse, Dad chided me in disgust. At school, the library, maybe even up at your grandma's. You'll find something better, Sarah. There's a lot out there. I didn't tell him that I had already hidden Shakespeare in my room and that I planned to see a lot more of him in the coming years. That he'd never be that kind of fire starter. That some things, even if they're dirty or filthy or used up or old, still can't be taken away once we know they exist. Like carnal knowledge, the experience makes all the difference. And my first time with Shakespeare was carnal. A sensual feast of words and images, things I never imagined before happened. Sweaty and scared and feeling a little foolish, I pulled the blankets closer overhead, reached for Shakespeare with one trembling hand, and with the other switched on a pocket flashlight and let it rest on my pillow. I didn't want it to be weird, but I had to see. I had to see, you know what I mean? It wasn't just me in bed. There was Shakespeare. And I wanted to see what he had to say, to put his words in my mouth and move my lips over them, to taste the words in my own voice on my tongue in the quiet of the night. So I turned Shakespeare over, opened him, laid him, made the book have two backs, and pressed my hand down flat against it. Then, fingers fumbling, rapidly breathing gasps of warm air onto the pages, I pushed record and began to read his words aloud. What was two became one. One awkward, stumbling, 12-year-old, infatuated voice saying the words of the bard. Reading into the tape recorder with William pressed against my pillow, I was also praying that my older sister, whose room was separated from mine by two thin sheets of wood paneling, wouldn't hear me. Praying my parents wouldn't get up for one of their surprise adult trips to the bathroom in the middle of the night. When sure we were all asleep, one of them would dash down the hallway, half-dressed or naked. I'd caught my parents making more than sweet and 20 before. Perhaps they had some precognition that I was about to open the door, so they were always in flight. My mother inevitably floated or was tossed into the air. I viewed her body naked and airborne in triplicate, reflected in the mirrors on all of their bedroom walls. My father, with his arms extended above him to catch her in mid-flight. Their lovemaking appeared to me like that of high-wire trapeze artists. Dangerous and dramatic, more acrobatics than amour. So it was to Shakespeare that I sought comfort, retreating from the sounds of my parents, the snoring of my sister, the rattling of the windows. It was he who left me shaken and unfulfilled, as all 12-year-old girls should be, I hope. And my parents never knew that I brought Shakespeare to bed with me. I doubt either one of them ever brought a book to bed and strayed into the early hours of morning, transfixed by words and unable to lie in slumber when a book was near. I was more in love with the midnight rendezvous, with the sound of my own voice, with the click of the turning wheels of the tape recorder and the heat massing under the sheets. The hope of the innocent to become less innocent while having no real idea what that means. His words awoke in me the love of rhythm and rhyme, the study of passion going wrong and sometimes going right. Betrayal, power, love, marriage, desire, kinship and friendship, tragedy and humor. I brought him to bed with me often and read. I understood very little, but I didn't care and wasn't guilty. It wasn't about an assignment, no quiz on Monday, no plan to impress my friends or family. I was looking closely and longing for each word, leaf by leaf, turning and stripping away the clothes of Adam and Eve with an innocence that Shakespeare never altered or tarnished, but that I lost in other ways, in other stories, all on my own. So you see, I never set out to rescue William Shakespeare, to record his works on audio for an audience of one, or to take him to bed with me. But sometimes, even a 12-year-old can get lucky.
Sarah Shoemaker is an adjunct instructor in the English department at the University of Central Arkansas and a freelance editor. She is also currently pursuing a BFA in studio art. She lives with her husband and son in the foothills of the Ouachita Mountains in Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to the Oxford American South on Main restaurant. Thank you to our live audience. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Driving with my big load, carrying it just so. This highway turns to dirt at the crossroad. See you when I get there. Fire in your hair, and you'll know me when you see me at the once have foretold this, might have been my big miss. They led him out with a sword and a kiss. Chariots of fire, faces of desire.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.